I'm Josh Cooperman, and this is Convo by Design. We've been spending a bit more time lately on showcasing the classics in architecture and design. That's why it's only fitting for the annual State of Iconic LA Architecture, our annual visit to City Hall, for a conversation with Ken Bernstein, manager and principal city planner in the Office of Historic Resources. I met Ken for the first time in 2016, and we spoke first on the podcast in 2017. We went back for an update, and there's so much happening with regard to Los Angeles architecture and design. We might have to visit a bit more often. If you're interested in LA's hidden gems, artisan housing, where to go and find amazing homes, walking tours, and more, Ken is going to share everything you need to know. This is a very special episode with Ken Bernstein from the Office of Historic Resources here in Los Angeles. Special thanks to the office and to Ken for making the time to catch up with us. Enjoy this conversation, and please note that it was recorded outside. And part of the joy for me in this episode is the constant activity and buzz that surrounds LA's beautiful City Hall. For those who are curious, the building was completed in 1928. Three lead architects on the project, Albert C. Martin, John C. Austin, and John Parkinson. The building was described by Austin in 1928 as modern America. The Art Deco structure is easily one of the most identifiable buildings in Los Angeles, and you probably remember the building from some of the film exteriors in which it appears, like Speed, Die Hard 2, or the original Dragnet. Way too many close-ups to list here. If you like what you hear, and I hope you do, please go to ratings and reviews on iTunes, leave us a note and a positive review. Positive ratings help us attract new listeners to the podcast. It's very much appreciated. Enjoy this episode of Convo by Design, presented by Snyder Diamond. Convo by Design, in our fifth season, and we've been presented by Snyder Diamond since episode number one. Snyder Diamond, always first with what's next in the kitchen and bath, is a relationship-based company. They're widely shopped and trusted by those in the business and homeowners alike because they have superior products and unmatched service. That's due to the people who work there, and it starts with second-generation president Russ Diamond. Russ travels extensively looking for the brands that provide the latest in technology and design for the kitchen and bath. In the kitchen, smarter appliances mean you can create amazing dishes. These appliances provide you with the tools to do your best work and delight the entire family. Miele is a brand that provides a remarkable line of smart appliances like ovens with MasterChef and MasterChef Plus. These offer 100 easy-to-use programs that let you simply choose a setting or a special cooking mode and trust that your cakes, bread, or meats will be cooked to perfection automatically every time. Miele has everything you need for the kitchen of your dreams, and you can find details, the full line of Miele appliances, and that superior Snyder Diamond service at all three Los Angeles area Snyder Diamond showrooms. More information is also available at SnyderDiamond.com. Okay, so remind Convo by Design listeners what the office does and when it started.
Sure. Well, we are the Historic Preservation Office for the City of Los Angeles. So we run the what is now the second largest historic preservation program in the United States, behind only New York, in terms of the size of the program that we have, the number of historic resources that are included in the program. Our office opened in 2006. We are part of the much larger Department of City Planning that handles all planning and development issues for the city, but we are the kind of focused office that deals with the identification and protection of our historic places in Los Angeles.
Okay, perfect. So, and I love that because it sort of dovetails nicely into the other aspects of historical preservation in Los Angeles. So your office works cooperatively with the LA Conservancy, of which you came from.
I did. And so I was the director of preservation issues for the Los Angeles Conservancy before coming to the city. I worked in city government before, went to the Conservancy, and then came back to open this new Office of Historic Resources. And it is a partnership, certainly, between the city and the Conservancy to protect our historic resources. The Conservancy is the nonprofit advocacy and education organization for not only the city of Los Angeles, but all of Los Angeles County in historic resources. And our office is the kind of internal governmental function of historic preservation. So these are very different roles, and the way I operate within these roles is certainly different. I recognize that in my role overseeing the preservation program, it is less of an advocacy role. At times, we are still the voice of historic preservation within city government and putting forward preservation values into the mix when they're being discussed here at City Hall. But it's a little bit different, and there are times when we may have to differ from our friends at the Conservancy or take a position, something that they are advocating for, that we find maybe it's a resource we don't think makes the cut in terms of eligibility to be a designated landmark or historic cultural monument in the city, or we might have a little bit of a different take. But it still is an invaluable partnership between our organization, our department, and the Conservancy. And we partner on a number of efforts around the city. We do a biannual Los Angeles Historic Neighborhoods Conference, for example, which is an opportunity to go to the public and really talk about how we can best preserve our historic neighborhoods in the city. We bring in all of our historic preservation overlay zone leaders, our HPOZs, or historic district leaders around the city, but go beyond that to reach advocates for their historic neighborhoods throughout Los Angeles and talk about tools and methods of better preserving the character of Los Angeles.
And I want to get into the HPOZs in just a minute, but I think you touched on something that's really interesting to me. So we've got a massive city here.
We sure do.
And I believe in our previous conversation, you mentioned you have 880,000 parcels.
Yes.
Which is just phenomenal when you try to think about managing the process. So what your office does is really you take inventory of the city, and I wanted to find out how the plan worked originally to take the inventory and the surveys that you did, but also, so there's a couple of different aspects to this, because you know one of the major issues in LA architecture is how landmarks, residences, remarkable structures just sort of wind up disappearing over time because it's hard to manage. So your office handles the inventory.
Yes.
The LA Conservancy handles the education mm-hmm. process, if you will. And then there's got to be that third element, which is kind of like the teeth that makes it stick. So how do the departments work together without it becoming too bureaucratic?
No, that's a great question. The inventory really has been key. And I think we talked last time, but just to reiterate, you know, we've just recently completed Survey LA, our citywide historic resources survey project. This was about a decade-long effort, a partnership between the city and the Getty to fund the city's first ever comprehensive inventory of our historic resources. And that is particularly important in a city the size of Los Angeles, because most of Los Angeles previously had been essentially a blank slate for preservation. We didn't know what and where our historic resources were in most corners of the city. We've now completed surveys in all 35 of our community plan areas of Los Angeles. Literally, we had teams going down every street and looking at every one of those 880,000 parcels in Los Angeles and kind of sorting out the wheat from the chaff, so to speak, really identifying what is significant and what is less so. And that's the basic underpinnings of our historic preservation program, that identification. We're now integrating all of that data into what is our inventory, what we call Historic Places LA. It's online at historicplacesla.org. Not all the data from the surveys are yet in the system, but we hope in a few months that they will be, so that will be essentially our comprehensive inventory of all of our historic resources in Los Angeles. That is then coupled, as you indicated, with the advocacy and education work of the Conservancy to help raise awareness among owners of those properties, among community members throughout the city about what is significant. And the Conservancy has the ability then to do things like educational programming, walking tours, other special presentations and educational programming to raise awareness. And then that in turn is coupled with the regulatory side of what we do. Our Office of Historic Resources does oversee the historic designation programs of the city. That includes our historic cultural monument designation program. We have about 1,100 plus local landmarks or historic cultural monuments, about 21,000 properties that are in our HPOZs or historic preservation overlay zones. And we review permits for properties that are designated. So they get referred to us, and that's the teeth. That's where that becomes involved. Not all the properties that are surveyed have those teeth, because that's kind of the basis for helping us determine what should be included, what should be designated in the future. But those properties that have that level of historic designation, that's where the teeth come in, and that's where the permit review comes into play.
So what's the process, and what are the teeth? Say, for example, so if someone comes in, because this, you know, there have been stories, well-documented stories. There's a Neutra or a Schindler or a Lautner. One day it's there, and the next day it's not. Not necessarily the wholesale changes to an to a landmark or a piece, but where it's just one day it's there, the next
demolition.
Day it's, demolition. Because in a city like this, you know, the dirt becomes more valuable than the property. So what are the ramifications?
Well, it is a city requirement that no work or substantial alteration should take place to a designated historic structure without our review, the Office of Historic Resources, or for a city historic cultural monument, the Cultural Heritage Commission of the city that we serve as the professional staff for. But if there is demolition without a permit, if someone goes ahead and has not met the requirements, not been reviewed by our office, and goes ahead and pursues demolition nonetheless without a permit, we actually do in Los Angeles have something that we call the Scorched Earth Ordinance, which is a nickname for an ordinance in the city that allows the Department of Building and Safety to impose a penalty of not allowing the property owner to construct on that property for up to a five-year period. And that can be a significant deterrent, and we have seen that invoked. We had a historic cultural monument that was a multifamily apartment building that was demolished about 5 years ago now, without permits. They went in on a Saturday and just cleared it away, didn't even bother to abate the asbestos. The asbestos was sent flying through the neighborhood, demolished without permit, and we worked with the Department of Building and Safety to impose the Scorched Earth Ordinance on that property. It has sat vacant for 5 years. That's a difficult thing to impose, because neighbors then have to look at a vacant lot for a time period, and that is difficult to impose on neighborhoods. But we think it's important to follow through in cases like that, both to send a message to the perpetrator that you can't just flout our historic preservation laws in the city, but also to be a deterrent going forward to anyone else who might contemplate the same.
What is the scorched earth policy? It's financial. It's punitive and financial.
Well, if you can't construct on a property for up to 5 years, and you're demolishing that building with the expectation you're going to be building something new and reaping income from that property, that's a significant penalty.
So the penalty is basically a 5 year moratorium on building.
Moratorium for up to 5 years.
I see. And I would imagine that that's not something you have to impose often.
No, we've done it a handful of times since
yeah.
I've been here, but
yeah.
But it's an important deterrent at the very least.
So in 1962, we had the Cultural Heritage Ordinance. It was in Los Angeles to protect historical and cultural landmarks, but I think when we spoke last time, you mentioned that it didn't really do enough on the residential or unmarked. So it wasn't as comprehensive, and I'm wondering, the plan that you guys are working with, and I want to talk about the HPLZs, is to put together a comprehensive plan. I'm trying to back up and think, how do you inventory 880,000 parcels? And you mentioned that you have people walking the streets, and now the process is to put it online and to make it available for people to research, which is great. Your office is not huge. How do you manage that process?
It's not. And fortunately, we had a great team of consultants that we were able to retain with funding from the Getty in particular, a multi-year grant from the Getty to enable us to bring in some of the... This was a project. It really takes a village to do a citywide survey in a city the size of Los Angeles. And it really took the entire preservation community and professional preservation community of Los Angeles to get this done. So that survey, fortunately, is now complete, but we did it in multiple phases over many years and made our way through the city. The challenge now is to really weave that information into an even more robust and comprehensive preservation program in the city. And how do we, now that we know what and where our historic resources are, to use that to guide, for example, the updates of our community plans in Los Angeles, so that as we plan for how and where we're going to grow as a city, and we're trying to focus growth around transit stops, for example, how do we protect our historic resources while we're at it? And how do we, as a result, create additional protections particularly when we're looking at our community plans and neighborhood plans in the city, to use this data as a planning tool. So that's really what Survey LA has now enabled, to use that as a guide moving forward. When you mentioned that the original cultural heritage ordinance didn't protect residences, actually the majority of our designated historic cultural monuments are residential structures, but it perhaps didn't look comprehensively at neighborhoods, and that's where our HPOZ program, Historic Preservation Overlay Zone program, or historic districts, come in. That was passed originally in the late 1970s. Angelino Heights was the first one, and we've now grown from that one up to 35 HPOZs in the city with about 21,000 structures across Los Angeles. So,
and how are they defined?
They're defined often by the neighborhoods themselves, and ultimately defined by the city council, which adopts a boundary for the HPOZs, but that kind of bubbles up from the communities as to what is the historic neighborhood that we're trying to protect. And so it's a bottom-up and a top-down process in many ways. But again, that's a partnership between our office and local communities to help protect the qualities and character that really defines our historic neighborhoods in Los Angeles. It's a lengthy process. It's not easy. A lot of outreach goes into that process because, as you can imagine, not every property owner in HPOZ, or not every property owner in a proposed HPOZ, is necessarily enthused to hear that their neighborhood's being considered for historic district status. A lot of questions come up. What does it mean for my property rights? Well, how will it affect my property values? Do I want my property to have another level of review by city government that it doesn't have today? So we have a lot of very lively discussions in some of those communities and spend a lot of time working with local neighborhood advocates and answering questions before that goes through any type of approval process. Ultimately, it goes through an approval process with the LA City Council.
It's interesting that you mention property rights and the rights of property owners, because it's a really big issue. It's a major issue. We're having that, you know, here in the county of Los Angeles with fault lines and certain buildings that were built on fault lines at the time without getting proper. But when an entire building is constructed and then there's a problem with it and you have to go back and look at it, I digress. I bring it up because last time we spoke, you were mentioning Penn Station, demolished in the late 60s, mid-late 60s, and what came out of that was an ordinance to preserve historical relevant landmarks in New York. What I think was interesting is if you read the ordinance, if you read the goal of the ordinance, it was to do things like protect tourism, to preserve the economy, it was never necessarily about the art of the structure itself, which I find interesting. It was never done. It wasn't, at least the stated goals, it wasn't done for art's sake. It was done for really financial reasons. It was tourism. It was the economy. It was to preserve the integrity of the property values. And so when you have a situation like that, how do you balance the sake of art and culture and property values? And I add to that, in many cases, because you're working with city groups in each individual city where they're, you know, neighborhood communities, that sort of thing, oftentimes you'll be dealing with business owners. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes you'll be dealing with property owners and not necessarily those that are as concerned with the arts and preservation side of it. How do you manage that?
Yeah, it is a careful balancing act. You're right. And I think, first of all, with property rights, it's important to point out to begin with that property rights are never absolute. People have the view that, well, my home is my castle, I can do what I want, I can build what I want. But that's not in fact the case. I mean, most cities have strict zoning laws regardless. And if you're in a single family neighborhood, you're not going to be building a high rise structure, for example. And you have layers upon layers of review already, including building permit requirements, other code requirements that constrain and shape what you can build and what that building envelope is on your property regardless. So historic preservation review adds another set of values into the mix, but it's within an already constrained set of property rights. But it's important to point out as well that it really is about balancing those individual property rights with the property rights of one's neighbors and the community as a whole, because it has really been shown in neighborhood after neighborhood across the country that when you're in a very cohesive, well-preserved historic district, property values for all rise. It lifts all boats in both how individuals enjoy the property rights they have and the property values that accrue to them in those neighborhoods. So maintaining that balance, having, we hope, a very sensible type of historic preservation control, a review process that makes sense and that preserves the overall character of a historic neighborhood, benefits the individual property owner in benefiting all of their neighbors and the neighborhood as a whole, and then, as you point out, benefits the city as a whole, because these are neighborhoods that people want to visit, that people want to continue to invest in. We're seeing in Los Angeles growing interest in cultural tourism, and we know from research that's been done that those who come to Los Angeles for cultural tourism purposes, as opposed to just visiting Disneyland or Universal Studios, tend to stay longer, tend to spend more money in local stores and businesses and restaurants, and it does benefit the economy as a whole, but we can only get there if we have our significant historic places well-preserved, well-protected, so people can continue to visit them and enjoy those neighborhoods and those sites.
You also mentioned previously about city planning. I love this topic. I really do. As a native Angeleno, for decades, sort of watching the morphing and changing. This is a remarkable city, and it's ever changing, and it's fun to watch. At the same time, if you're not from here or you haven't been here a while, if you're just dropped in, or let's say you live in New York and you hear about LA and you follow the ups and downs of architecture and the way we live, it seems haphazard. It seems arbitrary how LA was designed. It's sprawling, it's spread out, and the way things come and go, it seems like the approach to arts and culture, at least the jab, is that it's temporary, it's not permanent. That we can't be a world-class architectural city because, you know, we don't take it seriously. That is a perception. So the first step to growing, right, is inventory and taking count of everything, and then applying a reasonable planning strategy. How do you do that in a city this big with as many parcels as you have to manage? How do you approach that?
Well, it's a big question. I always take exception to the myth that Los Angeles doesn't care about its history and culture, and that Los Angeles is a city that wasn't planned. In fact, Los Angeles looks the way it does because it was, in fact, planned that way. In many ways, Los Angeles, people think of Los Angeles as a freeway metropolis, for example. Los Angeles was actually planned around being a streetcar city, going back to Henry Huntington, the development of the Pacific Electric System. It was a thoughtful approach to develop a transit system and to build around that. We are sprawling in large in part because that was a response to water and Los Angeles and William Mulholland bringing in the aqueduct into Los Angeles, and then communities being consolidated into Los Angeles as an opportunity to take advantage of that water. So there are those big ideas, those big themes that really shaped why Los Angeles looks the way it does. And there's an opportunity right now. It's an exciting time for planning in Los Angeles because there is an opportunity to reshape the city, particularly around our major transit investment. Los Angeles voters have twice now approved sales tax increases for a significant transit investment, and to continue to provide that choice and that access. We're not asking people to give up their cars, certainly, but to provide that opportunity for people to live in a very different way than they might have, going back to that original idea of Los Angeles as a transit-oriented community. And so kind of weaving historic preservation into that then is, you know, again, how do we maintain Los Angeles as a cutting-edge city, and we've always been a city of design, creativity, exciting new construction, and a changing city in terms of how we operate from a planning perspective, being a more transit-oriented, walkable, pedestrian-oriented metropolis, and still protect those places that really define our city and each of our communities. That's why the inventory, that's why our historic preservation controls are so key to that overall planning process.
Okay, and I get that. But in all fairness, let's back up for 1 second. I'm going to challenge you on something. You're absolutely right about the streetcars. But look what we did to them. You know, so you're right, but you plan this great, and we had probably the most advanced streetcar, trolley car system of any city that I know of. Covered more mileage. It was efficient. It was effective. It was inexpensive, and it was demolished.
Yeah.
So you plan a city one way for that. Now you try to come back and build on a new rail platform, whereas the properties don't necessarily align with where the metro system goes. So again, back to your department, what role would you like your office to have in the overall scheme of the planning of Los Angeles?
Yeah, I think we do have, and we'll continue to have, I think, a very central role in the planning of the city. And we are, I think it's always been very important that the Office of Historic Resources be part of the planning department. And I may have referred to this when we spoke last year, but the Historic Cultural Monument Program previously was in the Cultural Affairs Department of the city. And for the reasons you indicated in terms of the New York program and the New York ordinance, it is in part about arts and culture. That's very important. But it's even more important that we be at the table when planning decisions are being made and when the development team, developers are coming into our department's offices to talk about a project that they may be envisioning that might have an adverse effect on historic resources, that we're at the table and looking at ways of shaping those designs, that we're at the table shaping the plans that help guide where and how growth is going to take place in the city. So it's very important that we be well integrated into the planning process. We also work very closely with other city departments that have their own plans, whether it's the Recreation and Parks Department, our Bureau of Engineering, and many others, and kind of serve as that in-house planning consultant when historic resources are at stake. So it's very important that the historic preservation function be front and center as we continue to look at planning in the city.
Remind me your boundaries.
Geographic boundaries?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we are bounded by the city of Los Angeles, so we're about 470 square miles. And I think for those who don't know the Los Angeles area well, it's important to realize that city of Los Angeles is one of 88 municipalities in Los Angeles County. So, but the 470 square miles is plenty for us to take on. We don't feel a need to overstep into other municipal boundaries. But that includes a multiplicity of communities. So very urban centers such as downtown where we now stand, Hollywood and elsewhere, all the way to the North San Fernando Valley, which includes very semi-rural, rustic communities that are equestrian in nature, down to our harbor communities, our very vibrant West Side, South LA, which has dealt with a great deal of economic challenges, the east side of the city. So it's a great diversity of socioeconomic levels. Obviously, Los Angeles is probably the most diverse city in the nation in terms of our people and our cultures. So it is a very rich and vibrant place to think about and to work on historic preservation.
Yeah, it is. And that was the thing, too. I think even people, it was funny you said those not familiar with L.A., I am extremely familiar with L.A., but I didn't realize that what you do actually encompasses certain areas like the far San Fernando Valley. And I wanted to ask you about a couple of areas. It's Modernism Week in Palm Springs, and I was reminded in Balboa Highlands, Granada Hills, the Eichler Tract.
Yeah, that's one of our HPOZs. It's our farthest north HPOZ in the city. It's our one of only two post-World War II HPOZs that we have, and our youngest because it was developed in the early 1960s. A great neighborhood. It's our only Eichler track. Joseph Eichler developed about 10,000 or so homes in the Bay Area. He only developed, I think, three tracts in Southern California, one in the city of L.A. And this is a neighborhood that really was meant to bring modernism to the masses, with each of the homes built around a lovely atrium, a glass-enclosed atrium, variety of roof lines, some flat roofs, some an A-frame roof. And this is at the northern edge of the valley with typically views overlooking the North San Fernando Valley. You can see where the aqueduct and the water comes into the San Fernando Valley from the Balboa Highlands neighborhood. And we would love to see more post-World War II modernist neighborhoods like this take that step to become HBOZs.
So, and it's interesting, now go from there to our very first HBOZ, which is Angelino Heights, and now we're at Victorian Homes.
That's right. So, you know, unfortunately, we lost the Victorian Homes of Bunker Hill in downtown Los Angeles from the same era, but we did preserve this neighborhood, particularly along Carroll Avenue, which is a National Register Historic District in Angelino Heights. Some incredible homes from the 1880s and 1890s, some of the later development in the early 1900s in Angelino Heights. It was the first HPOZ. That neighborhood got organized and really was what propelled the adoption of our HPOZ ordinance for the city in 1979. And Angelino Heights, I believe, was adopted in 1983. And it's a neighborhood that you know, has really benefited from becoming an HPOZ. We've seen tremendous reinvestment in many of those homes. If you looked at that neighborhood in the early 1980s, many of the homes were very dilapidated, and it was a neighborhood that was really struggling. Would those homes, would that neighborhood be preserved as a historic district? Angelino Heights has tremendously benefited from its HPOZ status. We've seen numerous new home buyers come in, rehabilitate those structures, and we even expanded the boundaries of the Angelino Heights HPOZ to encompass more of the bottom of the hill. It goes up a hillside. The original 1880s neighborhood is at the top, and some of the slightly later early 20th century development around the ring at the bottom of the hill, and that was added later because those neighbors really wanted to see the benefits of historic preservation come to that extended part of Angelino Heights, also to be able to take advantage of our Mills Act Historical Property Contract Program, which is a financial incentive program for owners of historic properties in our HPOZs and owners of our historic cultural monuments. So a number of homeowners have taken advantage of that incentive as well.
Which is really, it's a great incentive, and it's kind of nice to have the carrot on the other side of the stick.
Exactly. We believe in not being the office that always has to say no and being only regulatory, but to have the benefits to offer. This is a tangible financial benefit, one of the few ways you can actually save on your property taxes in the city of Los Angeles by making a commitment to historic preservation.
Which is great. Wanted to talk to you about something else, too. And forgive me, because I'm not sure if this falls under your office's responsibilities or not, but I think it's interesting nonetheless, and I'd love to hear your take on it. You know, the city of L.A. owns and manages some remarkable properties. You know, a list of those. It includes Pershing Square, the Point Fermin Lighthouse, South Seas House, Campo de Cahuenga, Waddles Mansion, which I want to ask you about, the Andres Pico Adobe, the Griffith Observatory. There's a number of, really, the Hill Palmer House. So we've got all types of architecture and properties. Does that fall at all under your office's responsibility? And what's the approach to your own management of historical properties?
No, that's a great question. I alluded to it earlier that in terms of our partnership with other city departments, we don't actually own, and Office of Historic Resources does not manage any of those properties, but we do have oversight over potential work to be done to those properties. Most of the ones you've mentioned are city historic cultural monuments, so any work that's done does get reviewed by our office. The majority of the ones you've mentioned are under the auspices of the Recreation and Parks Department. They fall within city parks, such as Griffith Observatory. Point Fermin Lighthouse actually has not been a city property, it is now being transferred to the city. And we've been in discussions with Recreation and Parks and the federal government, which is making that transfer to the city. We hope that will become a city historic cultural monument and will be reviewed under our program. Watts Towers is another. In that case, it's the Cultural Affairs Department that has been the lead in overseeing that work. They've partnered with LACMA, LA County Museum of Art, and other outside entities to help continue to preserve. It's an ongoing challenge to in terms of upkeep and maintenance of sites such as Watts Towers. But it really, again, is about partnerships, typically between our department and other city agencies such as Recreation and Parks. And, you know, often during difficult economic times, I think the challenge is to ensure that there's adequate resources for those other agencies to continually reinvest in those buildings. Though Griffith Park, the observatory has had a wonderful nonprofit support group that really helped fund its expansion and ongoing maintenance. Not every building, historic building in the city, has that type of local partnership to ensure that the funding is there in difficult times as well as good ones.
One project in particular, or one property in particular, rather, is Waddell's Mansion.
Uh-huh.
So it's really interesting because last year I covered the design house of Waddell's. So when they turn Waddell's Mansion into a design house and they have the designers come in and sort of reimagine the space, it's really interesting. It's like no other design house project I've ever been experienced with or seen, because the restrictions that go into this. I mean, you still got a property that has knob and tube electrical. It's very, very original.
Yeah.
It's still very original, even though designers come in and they sort of reimagine with things like paint, and you know, there are certain things that they can't do. When that happens, that must be a real challenge, trying to go between, okay, we want to let you be creative and artistic, but we also can't let you touch this whole long list of things.
Right, and again, that gets to our partnership with Recreation and Parks, so they manage that site. And you know, going in for a temporary period of time and doing something that's very reversible is one thing. Going in and making changes that are irreversible are quite another. But Waddell's is an example of what I was mentioning, and kind of needing to have longer-term sources of funding. I think there's a lot of deferred maintenance and work that needs to happen at Waddell's that still hasn't. Another site like that that Recreation and Parks manages is the Lummis House in the Highland Park neighborhood. Charles Fletcher Lummis, legendary figure in the history of Los Angeles, creator of the Southwest Museum, a true Renaissance man, created the whole Arroyo culture in Northeast LA, and that was his home. And it was the home of, it had long-term lease with the Historical Society of Southern California. Recreation and Parks really decided that they'd like to take a different approach, but it is looking for a longer-term solution and funding to ensure that that can continue to be rehabilitated and maintained. And again, we're there as a resource for Recreation and Parks and community members in situations like that to help think through positive solutions. The Southwest Museum as well, nearby, that Lummis was so associated with, the Autry is going through much a similar exercise to figure out how best to preserve and reuse that property moving forward.
So, follow up, because I'm curious. It's one thing to need funding. It's another thing to ask for funding, and it's a third thing to sort of provide the quid pro quo when going for funding. So you can get funding from the government, which is, you know, it's a challenge, it's difficult to do, taxpayer money. Then there's private sector, right? And then what do we provide to that business or that company? Are they doing it out of the goodness of their heart, or are they doing it for some sort of exposure or coverage, or to be able to leverage that involvement? Am I way over the tip of my skis on this one? Is that how you evaluate it? How do you source funding to do that? Because it's a great point. And let me back up a second. Last year when we were at Waddell's, it was really cool what the designers did. And we got to document it, and the videos are there, and the conversation, really great stuff. But at the same time, there were parts of the Waddell's Mansion complex that we couldn't get to or couldn't see because, you know, there was one structure that had burned down decades ago before the city took real control of it. But how do you do that?
Well, I should say, you know, we're not really the lead in managing those properties and being out there looking for funding sources. We do try to, again, be a partner and support funding applications when recreation parks or another entity is pursuing that. I think they do events like the Design House or other special events and properties like that in part to continue to raise funding. And I think what's often important is that those buildings, those sites, have a strong community support group that is that can do things that city government cannot, whether it's recreation and parks or our department. They can be more nimble in seeking corporate sponsorships, in pursuing special events, and so forth. We've been involved working with recreation and parks. There's a home in the San Fernando Valley, the Oak Ridge Estate, designed by Paul R. Williams, the pioneering African-American architect in Northridge. And it's been acquired now by the city. It really speaks to Hollywood history with Barbara Stanwyck's estate, as well as the B-movie actor Jack Oakey. So it's the last of the kind of San Fernando Valley ranchettes that many movie stars had in the 30s and 40s, and a Paul Williams house. You know, it's an incredible site, but it needs funding. And so there is a community group as well that's out there with a former city councilman trying to continually raise money to do just that. And so we're here really as a resource and as a partner to help groups, meet those needs for historic sites.
Last question I had for you is, as you look forward to the next year, because it really is, if you look at the gravity of what your office has done in the last 10 years, it's pretty amazing. So now you've got everything inventoried. Now the challenge is putting it out there in a way that's easily consumable, you know, and easily trackable and easily, so you can research it. Your goals over, when do you think, and how would you like, if you had your choice, how would you make this available?
Well, I think in today's world, we're making this available online. Again, that's why we've put a lot of resources into Historic Places LA, creating that one central repository for our inventory moving forward. But, you know, looking ahead to the next year, I think it's going to be a year of really beginning to use the survey. Our focus is really now in implementation. How do we use the work that we've done thus far, laying that groundwork to do good planning in the city? And the city now has resources to do updates of our community plans and our long-range plans to an extent that we haven't had really in decades, to be able to do a great number of those plans simultaneously. The goal is to do all of our community plan updates in the next 6 years. So it's a golden opportunity now to use that rich data to inform good planning. And then we also really want to get a handle in the next year on our HPOZ program, since I mentioned that we added 5 new HPOZs this past year. We have 35 neighborhoods in the city. You know, it's a burgeoning program, but in some ways we don't want it to become a victim of its own success and not be able to manage and properly service these neighborhoods that struggled so hard to become historic districts. So we're trying to make our program more manageable, and one of the ways we're doing that, we adopted a city ordinance that allows multiple HPOZs to share a single HPOZ board. So contiguous neighborhoods, we adopted the Carthay Square HPOZ last year. They're adjacent to the Carthay Circle and South Carthay HPOZ neighborhoods. We didn't see any reason that all three should continue to have a separate 5-member board where the program could be streamlined and those three could share a single 7-member board. And in streamlining the program, allow for the future growth and expansion to other neighborhoods in the city that have been identified through Survey LA or other means as also appearing worthy for designation. So it's a year for us of kind of implementation on the one hand, consolidation and planning for, we hope, the future growth and expansion of our efforts to protect Los Angeles' heritage.
That's great. So, you know what? Thank you. You just put the perfect bow on that. I love it. I appreciate it. So, we're gonna come back again next year, and hopefully have
Sounds
another.
Good. I hope we've done everything we're ever gonna do.
Yeah, it'll be great.
Always great to visit with you.
Likewise, Ken. Thank you.
Thank you.
Convo by Design is proud to be working with Vendome Furniture. Their design culture is the key to their success, It's what pushes them to consistently create new collections that give spaces a new dimension. They create dialogue between environment and form. Vendome pieces can transform the simplest space into one filled with glamour that is both unique and extraordinary. And isn't that what design is all about? Creating atmospheres where you can take hold of life and enjoy it to the fullest? Vendome products are simple and elegant, contemporary and exceptionally comfortable. Their crafted, modern, durable, molded resin, glass, and metal designs are unique. They beg to be enjoyed. Have you seen them featured in our videos? Check out our YouTube channel and see this for yourself. You can also find them in their showrooms at the D&D Building in New York, Wynwood in Miami, and the Pacific Design Center here in Los Angeles, or online at vendome.com.